Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we have some important news about a lawsuit filed by an East County citizens group against top officers of the California Public Utilities Commission and a major energy company, and what that could mean for ratepayers here in San Diego. We'll tell you about donation of over $1 million made to help athletes at San Diego State University. And on our Capitol Report, you'll learn the latest news about the controversial XL pipeline in Congress. On our local government report, we'll include a preview of agenda items coming up this week before East County's boards and councils. Cold weather is here, and we'll tell you about a frost warning issued for tonight. We'll have details on a sexually violent predator that the state wants to release in Hacumba Hot Springs and how you can register your comments. Our newsmaker interview today is with Tyler Strauss from the Outliers Collective, which is San Diego's only legally licensed medical marijuana cooperative here in El Cajon. From Public News Service, we'll have reports about strategies for reducing poverty in California and some positive news about getting health care coverage for Hispanic Californians. Hear about a deadline extension for public comments on a controversial plan to open up millions of acres of desert for renewable energy projects. Learn about traces of radiation from the Fukushima nuclear disaster that have now reached the West Coast, and why one scientist says he's not afraid to swim in the water. On Bookshelf, Raina Menashe interviews Don Harrison, author of Schlepping Through the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. We'll also tell you about some volunteer opportunities in Alpine, and we'll have tips for travelers in need of passports for the holidays. So stay tuned for all of this and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. Citizens Oversight and the law firm of Aguirre & Severson have filed a federal lawsuit against two top Public Utilities Commission officials and against Southern California Edison for allegedly violating the constitutional rights of ratepayers through San Diego Gas & Electric and Edison by taking money without just compensation. The federal lawsuit exposes how two public officials with a history of granting favors to utility executives allowed enormous overcharges for the failed San Onofre nuclear power plant in violation of the just compensation provision in the U.S. Constitution. Ratepayers were allegedly charged for power that was never generated after the facility was shut down for safety reasons. The suit seeks restitution of $3 billion to ratepayers. Over 17 million utility ratepayers have been harmed by what the plaintiffs call an unlawful billing scheme, the suit contends. Ray Lutz, founder of the nonprofit Citizens Oversight Group in El Cajon, said of the San Onofre safety violations, "It's clear the utility has completely rigged the system in their favor. They didn't even have a hearing in the investigation to find out who was at fault." Lutz's group filed the lawsuit that's being handled by former city attorney Mike Aguirre and consumer attorney Maria Severson. The legal action argues that the two most powerful public utilities commissioners, Michael Florio and disgraced commission president Michael Peavy, engaged in scheduling shenanigans that quashed a legally required internal investigation into the reasonableness of charging ratepayers for electricity that they never received. By avoiding the legally required hearings, the PUC allowed Edison to take the property of over 17 million citizens without just compensation in violation of their Fifth Amendment right, according to the lawsuit. Peavy, the former chief executive of PG&E, has announced his resignation at year's end after public records requests revealed improper emails that showed a Peavy staffer promising favorable treatment to PG&E involving the deadly San Bruno pipeline explosion. Peavy and Florio have previously been wined and dined extensively by utilities that they are supposed to regulate, including San Diego Gas & Electric Company, San Diego's power provider. Citizens Oversight obtained over 7,200 pages of emails and other correspondence as a result of the California Public Records Act related to that San Bruno pipeline explosion that killed 8 people, injured scores more, and demolished several city blocks back in 2010. The Citizens Oversight website states, "These emails show a pattern of close coordination between the CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, and the utilities they are supposed to regulate, including PG&E. An initial reading shows a pattern of collusion to manipulate stock prices, coordinate press releases, shop for judges, and rig the proceedings to benefit the utilities. We believe this culture of corruption goes beyond isolated incidents, Citizen Oversight's website adds, concluding that the problem is systemic in extent. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Don Coryell was the most winning coach in Aztec football history at San Diego State University. Now, the Coryell Legacy Project has been launched to provide scholarship funds to student athletes. Bill and Robin Sinclair have donated $1.25 million to launch the Coryell Legacy. The project seeks to raise $20 million through endowments to ensure financial stability of the school's athletic programs and the success of its student athletes. Robin Sinclair said, "Bill and I are not alumni, but we love the Aztecs." Bill Sinclair compared building an endowment to building a sports team. A steady stream of new recruits maintains the program's strengths. Legacy giving will keep the university growing and guarantee its future, he said. To Aztec athletes, the Sinclairs are good sports indeed. For more information on the Aztec Club and the Coryell Legacy, visit the Aztec Club website at goaztecs.com/Aztec Club. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. Congress wasted no time after the election passing the Keystone XL pipeline by a 252-161 margin, with all Republicans voting in favor along with several Democrats. The measure next goes to the Senate, where it will likely pass once the new Republican majority is seated. If approved, however, it could face a veto from President Obama. The pipeline would carry massive amounts of heavy crude oil from Canada's tar sands to refineries on the Gulf of Mexico. NASA's top climate scientist, James Hansen, has warned that if the pipeline is built, it will be, quote, game over, unquote, for stabilization of climate change because of the massive amounts of carbon that would be released. The San Diego congressional delegation followed party lines in the vote Friday to approve construction of the controversial pipeline. Democrats Susan Davis, Scott Peters, and Juan Vargas voted against the project, while Republicans Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa voted for it. Congresswoman Davis said this bill is essentially an earmark for a Canadian oil company. Keystone will have virtually no impact on job creation and an unnoticeable effect on gas prices, she said, adding, the project is very high on environmental risks and very low on reward. But Congressman Issa said Congress made the economy a priority and created thousands of new jobs by passing legislation to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. This project will go far in stabilizing our energy sector while creating highly technical and skilled labor jobs for years to come, Congressman Issa concluded.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine's Local Government Report. The El Cajon City Council will meet on Tuesday, November 18th. This week, the council will vote on a staff recommendation to modernize City Hall and renovate Fire Station Number 6. Council will also hold a hearing on delinquent trash collection charges and on the Babylon Banquet Hall's application for an on-site sale of alcoholic beverages and joint-use parking. Matters involving the Magnolia Trails and Foundation Lane residential developments will also be on the agenda. Lemon Grove City Council meets Wednesday, November 19th. Council members will consider an ordinance that would clarify that marijuana dispensaries do not fit any city zoning categories and are illegal. This follows two ballot measures in which Lemon Grove voters rejected measures that would have allowed marijuana dispensaries in the city. Council will also consider approving use of community development block grants for street improvements. In addition, Lemon Grove's council members will consider whether to allow rezoning of several parcels on North Avenue to allow more heavily commercial uses. Helix Water Board also meets this Wednesday, November 19th. The board will discuss how to expend funds from a lawsuit settlement involving El Capitan Golf Club and El Monte Canyon, LLC. Board members will also vote on a proposed $225,000 pavement improvement project at Lake Jennings.
This is Miriam Raftery with a weather report. The National Weather Service has issued a frost warning for the high desert areas through Monday night. As cold air filters into the deserts and the winds drop off, clear skies and very dry air will allow temperatures to plummet below freezing. Freezing temperatures can damage sensitive crops and plants, so residents are advised to cover them or bring them inside if possible. West of the mountains, a freeze is not forecast, but temperatures will dip to chilly levels in the 30s and 40s in many locations, the National Weather Service forecasts.
This is Leon Thompson with an update on the proposed release of sexually violent predator Gary Snavely. The state has changed its proposed plans to place Snavely in Borrego Springs and now instead proposes placing him in Hakumba Hot Springs. A hearing is set for December 19th at 9 a.m. in San Diego Superior Court. Snavely is a diagnosed pedophile who was convicted in 1987 of molesting two girls between ages of 8 and 9 in Orange County. He served 3 years in prison but returned after violating parole. He was later released again, misused his medication, was sent back to state hospital before winning his latest petition for release. Supervisor Diane Jacob issued a statement opposing the release of Snavely and other predators into the community. She says, "These men are the worst of the worst, and allowing yet another one in our neighborhoods is bad for public safety and bad for all of us taxpayers who must cover the outrageous cost of housing these predators." A prior predator placed in Hakumba was arrested for breaking into the home of an elderly woman and sexually assaulting her, despite promises that he would be monitored. The public has the right to submit comments until November 21st by emailing sdsafe@sheriff.org or by testifying at the hearing on December 19th.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Leon Thompson, and you are listening to East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Medical marijuana is in the news, and here to talk about it today is the manager and spokesman for the only county-licensed dispensary, the Outliers Collective in El Cajon. Here with us today is Tyler Strauss. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The East Bay Express, which is a Northern California magazine, reported on medical marijuana initiatives from last week's election, and it said in San Diego, reformers asked Encinitas and La Mesa residents to cast their ballots on measures F and J, respectively, to permit dispensaries in those cities, but F and J failed and dispensaries remain banned. San Diego County has one licensed dispensary for 3 million people. My question to you is, what does it take to be a certified dispensary?
Well, unfortunately, I can't actually talk to a great deal as to what it took to get our doors open, but it involved a great deal of work to secure property as well as the license, both of which were required by in order to open our doors. The land use restrictions in San Diego County are pretty extreme. The number of locations that are permittable is very limited.
So that's why you ended up in the middle of the Gillespie Field Airport. There's a lot of open land around.
We actually ended up in the same location as the very first licensed dispensary in San Diego, which closed a few years ago in response after being evicted after their landlord got a letter from the DEA threatening civil asset forfeiture.
Oh my goodness. Where does the product come from?
All of our product is currently being sourced from our member sources. These are individual cultivators in the San Diego County and surrounding areas who are producing cannabis in excess of their personal use and are able to provide it to us so that we can then make it available to our members who are not able to cultivate for themselves. All of these member sources are subject to inspection by the Sheriff's Department. This ensures that all of our product is coming from a legal and compliant source.
Well, that was one of the questions I had. Friends of mine that have questions about dispensaries, where does this product come from and how do we know it doesn't come from some Mexican cartel? Or you say the product is tested as well?
So in the past few years, analytical laboratories have opened in California, which were able to provide testing for medical marijuana products. We do utilize those services as much as is possible. Given our current reliance on member sources, it's often difficult to get lab tests back before the product have already hit the shelves. Demand is considerable, and we want to make sure that we keep product on our shelf. But we do, all of our products are inspected in order to ensure that there's no visible mold or any sorts of contaminants that might be a risk to someone who uses it.
Are they organic?
Some of the products are organic. Companies that certify organic are not quite ready to begin certifying organic medical marijuana growers. So it's not a label that we put on a lot of our products because they're not necessarily certified organic despite the fact that they might grow organic.
What is CBD?
CBD is short for cannabidiol. Cannabidiol is a non-psychoactive cannabinoid, the second most common cannabinoid found in the cannabis plant. It's been reported to be effective in a number of different ailments. In particular, some pediatric epilepsy patients in Colorado have reported significant improvement in their symptoms, as was featured by Sanjay Gupta's two-part documentary, Weeds. There's a growing vocal community in San Diego of parents of children with epilepsy who are anxious for more supply of these types of products. And that really goes to our reliance on member sources, and encourage anybody with high CBD medicine that they don't need to make it available to us so that we can in turn make it available to our members who are desperate for it.
The cannabis that's high in CBD, is that metabolized from the hemp plant rather than...
Well, the distinction between the hemp and cannabis plants is really more a function of their use. They're the same plants. They can cross-pollinate. It's more of a legal distinction than a botanical distinction. Mm-hmm. It is certainly true that hemp contains higher amounts of CBD than THC. This is mostly because the amount of THC has been regulated in hemp for many, many years. And so the amount of THC found in hemp varietals is by law less than 1%.
Oh.
So this is a exciting potential source for CBD. Unfortunately, hemp cultivation in California or in the United States remains illegal, just the same as cannabis cultivation remains illegal under federal law. So domestic sources of CBD from hemp remains extremely limited, as it does from medical cannabis.
What about edibles? I've been hearing a lot of brownies and even gummy bears that are infused with cannabis.
Our ordinance does not allow us to carry edibles, despite the fact that many of our members request them because they would rather not smoke or vape their medicine. We're working on a solution for those individuals. Unfortunately, our ordinance just simply doesn't allow us to carry edibles in any form. So at this point, you know, I know that there is a need for edible products, and the issue is a complicated one because of the fact that medicated edible products look the same as non-medicated edible products.
Yes.
So I think that there needs to be discussions about appropriate labeling, dosing, and other considerations before we, you know, make edibles available widely.
Yes. Very interesting. You mentioned vapes. Is that a safer form of ingesting cannabis?
Well, smoking involves combustion, and there are lots of nasty byproducts that come from that process. Vaporizing involves heating the raw plant material to a point where the active ingredients become vaporized, are inhaled into your lungs. Since there's no combustion involved, there's considerably fewer of those byproducts. And so in terms of relative safety, vaporizing is considerably safer than smoking. It's also oftentimes easier on your throat because the temperatures involved are lower than a burning ember. So yeah, it's certainly safer than smoking.
For you who have tuned in late, we're talking with Tyler Strauss, who's the manager of the Outlier Collective, the only legal collective in San Diego County, serving 3 million people. Is full legalization inevitable? Kind of after your opinion on this, since you're close to this issue, will there be a vote in 2016 to legalize recreational marijuana in California?
I think that there will almost certainly be a vote in 2016 to legalize marijuana for adult use. I think that it's critically important that we have an effective and functioning medical marijuana market.
Right now, it appears that there's a lot of details that need to be kind of worked out in the operational way that marijuana is dispensed. Obviously, being the certified, you're kind of the ones who are setting the bar. Am I correct in saying that?
We're the first or the most recent to go through the process of operating under the San Diego County Medical Marijuana Ordinance as it was written when it was first passed. I think that there's a growing agreement that the ordinance could be improved. There are some serious issues with the member source inspection and the way that that process unfolds. In some cases, sheriff's inspectors will be required to inspect dirt because the product will have already been delivered to us before we will have informed them that we have a new member source who needs to be inspected and found to be in compliance with the law. I'm sure this is how the sheriffs would like their procedures to operate. It doesn't really make a lot of sense for sheriffs to inspect dirt and I think the intent was for them to inspect the actual plants. Unfortunately, that would require the county to get into the business of licensing cannabis growers. And that's something that I think is still a bridge too far for many, but I think they need to, you know, get comfortable with the fact that there is going to be a legal supply of medical marijuana in California. Right now, concerns about illicit sources of medical marijuana are best addressed by making licit sources of medical marijuana.
I see. Exactly. Recently, I've been reading that in Northern California, there have been these marijuana task force that have rappelled down ropes out of helicopters, even though in California, medical marijuana has been legal since 1996. We're the first state to actually legalize it. So what's going on?
The San Diego Medical Marijuana Task Force raided a small grow in Imperial Beach recently, operated by a gentleman named Marcus Boyd. They confiscated, this is my understanding, 45 plants, which were, as I learned, 10 mothers in a small tray of new clones that were going to be distributed to other medical marijuana patients in the Imperial Beach area so that they could grow their own medical cannabis. In the process, one of the officers involved had to take off his jacket because it was quite warm, and his t-shirt represented a cartoon animal carrying what I assume were cannabis plants, and it was a marijuana task force shirt, and on the bottom it said essentially F the growers, marijuana is illegal, ... That I think reflects a law enforcement sentiment that we really need to move past. It's not helpful as a licensed business in San Diego to see sworn sheriff's officers wearing shirts like that in public. Doesn't make me feel good as a taxpayer. I couldn't wear a shirt like that to work.
That's for sure.
And I'm not interested in making this any bigger deal. And I think that the sheriffs have responded in the only appropriate way they could by repudiating this attitude. I think that that's a start. And I think that as long as we continue to treat each other with some degree of respect and understanding that we have our respective jobs to do, that we don't need to rehash the battles of the past in order to resolve the issues of the present.
I appreciate the insight into all of this, Tyler. I appreciate that very much. And is there anything that we haven't covered right now that you wanted to perhaps talk about?
I think that the only thing that I'd like to address is that it's important for our elected officials to stand up and start to do their job and to get regulations in place that will allow qualified patients who have the right to use medical cannabis safe access to the medicine that they need. Otherwise, if the people of California, the voters in California, pass marijuana legalization in 2016, it's going to be a much more difficult path to a functioning, well-regulated industry. And as long as we can begin that process today, we can ensure that everybody's concerns are addressed in a way that is effective. It leads to an effective system that ensures everyone has safe, cost-effective access to medical marijuana.
There's probably 1,000 things we didn't get to, but that's okay too.
You know, my goal is obviously to try to engage outside of outliers as much as possible because mm-hmm. I had a very interesting meeting with Marcus Boyd the other day, and I was saying, you know, to a certain extent, we get credit for merely existing. And currently that's unfair because we don't have any licensed competition. So the fact that we're the only licensed dispensary in San Diego makes us the only licensed dispensary in San Diego. So 3 million people in San Diego, should they need access to medical marijuana, have one legal source.
Uh-huh.
As an activist and as an advocate, you know, for medical marijuana in general, I think the issues are broader than just us. Someone who lives in Imperial Beach shouldn't have to drive to El Cajon so that they don't have to break the law to get medical marijuana.
Good point.
Especially if they have limited mobility or disabled or otherwise unable to actually get out here. So I want this to be about shaming our elected officials into doing their job, representing their constituents, all of them, including those who need access to medical marijuana. They sure seem to do a good job of making sure everybody's got ready access to liquor. You know, I don't have to drive too far to get any other drug.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, there's certainly plenty of strip clubs around. So, you know, I think that there's reasonable and responsible safe access that can be implemented in a town like San Diego, despite the fact that we are a special case because we're a border town. And I understand that those issues are pressing, but from my perspective, that's all the more reason to ensure that illicit supply of medical marijuana exists in San Diego. Otherwise, the presumption that it's all illegal guarantees that it's all going to be illegal. You have to create space for lawful actors to exist in order to be able to tell the difference between a lawful and an unlawful actor. The unfortunate presumption amongst, you know, members of the San Diego law enforcement community is that you're guilty until the judge or the prosecutor decides to not press charges, in which case, yeah, you're still guilty, you're just not going to get prosecuted. So this presumption of guilt and, you know, let the system deal with you after the fact is a waste of departmental resources and doesn't work. We worked with the sheriff's department to develop our labeling so that if a member of law enforcement were to see our product in the hands of someone who, you know, is entitled to possess it, that they would be able to feel confident that the person who has a recommendation to use medical marijuana also has medical marijuana from the only licensed source in San Diego.
Oh.
It's got our name. It's got our license number. It's got the patient's doctor's name and their recommendation number. All of that information is on the label. So while it's not personally identifiable in and of itself, if you have your doctor's recommendation with you and your driver and your ID card, those three pieces of information can be used to confirm that, you know, you are entitled to possess what you are in possession of. These are the types of things that I feel we can show there's a solution to these problems.
Right.
Sheriffs complain that they can't tell the difference between legal marijuana and illegal marijuana. Sure, I can't label the actual plant, but I can put a label on the bag.
Right.
You know, it's a step in that direction.
It is.
You know, and it's at least acknowledging that, you know, yeah, sure, maybe we can, and we can improve that. You know, You know, there are techniques for gene stamping. I mean, these are the sorts of, you know, futuristic type things that we're not even really near, but we need to start addressing and talking about solutions to these problems rather than just, you know, accepting that prohibition is the only solution, because it's not. It's not a solution to anything. Cool.
We've been speaking with Tyler Strauss, who's the manager of the Outlier Collective in El Cajon, and appreciate the insights. Thank you so much for being with us, Tyler.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
Young families have a better chance to break the cycle of poverty when there are better coordinated efforts to help them succeed as a family unit. A new Annie E. Casey Foundation report stresses the need for a two-generation approach to policies aimed at lower-income families with young children. In California, nearly half of kids under age 8 live in low-income households. Patrice Cromwell with the Casey Foundation says what's needed is to integrate job, education, and parenting programs for adults with high-quality early learning for their kids so the family benefits as a whole.
It's not enough to invest in early childhood and parenting skills. We're encouraging states and local practitioners to look at both the parent and child needs together to help parents bring up their children in a stable environment.
Jessica Midnick with Children Now says the home visiting programs being piloted across California are good examples of what works. Trained professionals check in with young parents, helping them gain skills in a number of areas.
It is that two-generational approach, making sure that parents are receiving their education. A lot of times there's a GED component to that. It also is focusing on parents' mental health and making sure that they have strong parenting skills.
Midnick says young families in past generations also struggled but had the advantage of parents' paychecks that increased over time. She notes today the combination of more single-parent households, stagnant wages, fewer benefits, and high child care costs have made it much tougher to climb out of poverty. Cromwell points to a United Way-sponsored program in the Bay Area where Spark Action Centers for Parents are located in some public schools.
The parent can come in, work on budgeting, improving their credit, so at the same time they're dropping their child off at school, they're working on ways to strengthen their overall financial stability.
Cromwell says programs and services for children or parents have the best intentions but often are fragmented. She says a more family-centered approach also helps parents set good examples for their children as they work to build a more stable household. For Public News Service, I'm Chris Thomas.
In response to public requests, federal agencies have extended the public comment period for the draft Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan Environmental Impact Report and Environmental Impact Statement by 45 days. The comment period, originally scheduled to close on January 9th, will be extended until February 23rd, 2015. The draft plan designates vast tracts for large-scale renewable energy projects as well as other areas for conservation, covering over 22 million acres of land in multiple counties in California, including San Diego. The plan presents six alternative approaches for meeting renewable energy and conservation goals through the year 2040. For more information on the draft and how you can submit your comments, visit www.drecp.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
An oceanographer who has studied plutonium levels in the Black Sea after Chernobyl reports that small levels of radiation from the Fukushima nuclear power plant meltdowns in Japan have now reached waters off America's west coast. Ken Busseler, a PhD who specializes in studying marine radioactivity at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, published his comments in the new Reddit Journal of Science AMA series. No federal agency in the U.S. took on the task of measuring the radiation levels or funding scientists to do so, despite the 2011 Fukushima meltdowns following a massive earthquake and tsunami, and scientists' predictions that radiation would reach North America by 2014 or 2015. So scientists launched a crowdfunding campaign and organized citizen scientist volunteers to sample the West Coast from San Diego to Alaska and Hawaii, testing for signs of Fukushima radionuclides. identified by measuring cesium isotopes. While the radioactive cesium-134 has not been found on our beaches, small amounts of radioactivity from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster have been found in the ocean about 100 miles west of Eureka off the shore of Northern California. But he assures us that it's still safe to swim offshore, since even swimming 6 hours a day for a full year would expose you to less radiation than a single dental x-ray. It will not deter me from swimming in the Pacific, the oceanography expert concludes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
California agencies and nonprofits have stressed the value of health insurance for children, and in the Hispanic community, it's paying off. The state is one of three standouts in a new report that examines what 10 states are doing to cover Hispanic kids. It says California's rate of uninsured Hispanic children is just over 9.5%, compared to a national rate of 11.5%. Kristen Golden Testa is the California Health Director for the Children's Partnership. She says the big reasons for the state's headway are its early start on Medicaid expansion and a commitment to make the sign-up process easier for parents.
You know, our state made sure that we partnered with the local folks that know the individuals in the very specific communities rather than just putting things in Spanish, for example, because there's many different Spanish-speaking communities throughout California.
The report by the National Council of La Raza and the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says progress also has been made nationally. The rate of uninsured Hispanic children was almost 16% just 4 years ago. The report says a state's approach to covering children makes all the difference to Hispanic families who may worry that signing up will call parents' immigration status into question. Sonia Schwartz, a report co-author at the Georgetown Center, says that isn't the case, and she wishes every state's message was this clear.
It's safe to apply for coverage for their kids, and that help is available applying in Spanish, and that even if they've been turned down before when they've tried to apply for their kids, coverage is changing, there's more affordable coverage available now, and they should try again.
She notes 93% of Hispanic children in the U.S. are citizens, and Testa adds California now has a dual responsibility to its Hispanic families.
Keeping momentum up is not only continuing to enroll people, but making sure they keep their coverage. They have to renew every year, and so they need to know about how to renew. So it's introducing that whole process to them and making sure that process is easy, too.
For Public News Service, I'm Chris Thomas.
This is a public service announcement for the Backcountry Land Trust and the Endangered Habitats Conservancy. Volunteers are needed to help restore the watershed along Alpine Creek and habitat on Alpine Boulevard. On Saturday, November 15th and 22nd from 1 to 4 p.m., volunteers will help plant native trees, shrubs, and ground cover species to enhance native habitat along this important wildlife corridor through Alpine. Volunteers will learn skills such as identifying and caring for native plants, propagation by cutting and dividing plant stocks, building gopher cages, planting hedgerows, and irrigation techniques. If you would like to volunteer, meet at 505 Alpine Boulevard at 1 p.m. on November 15th or 22nd. Wear long sleeves and pants, sturdy shoes, work gloves, and sun protection. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Don Harrison, author of Schlepping Through the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. My guest, a seasoned journalist, is also editor and publisher of San Diego Jewish World, an online newspaper that serves the San Diego Jewish community and serves Jews around the world. So welcome, Don. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Raina, for having me.
Let's start with your history. I know that since 1986, you've been writing Jewish stories about events, people, and places not only in San Diego, but in the rest of the country and the world. How did you get started writing Jewish stories?
Well, I had been a journalist before. I had been the political writer for the San Diego Union. And then I got into public relations and found myself missing journalism. About the same time, my daughter, Sandy, had her bat mitzvah. And I had come from a family that wasn't all that involved with the Jewish community, and I never had a bar mitzvah as a kid. And they have a ceremony where they pass down the Torah from generation to generation. And as I watched it go briefly into my arms and then to her arms, I thought, wow, she's inherited a heritage that I don't have. I want to learn more about this. And I thought, well, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. The best way I can learn is if I start writing stories about the Jewish community. And I volunteered to write stories for one of the Jewish newspapers, the San Diego Jewish Press Heritage, which ultimately I became the editor-in-chief and later the publisher of.
And do you remember your first Jewish story?
Yes. Actually, it was a trialogue among three rabbis from the different movements. One was a rabbi from the Orthodox Beth Jacob. His name was Rabbi Langer. The other one was a rabbi from the conservative Tiferet Israel, and that was Aaron Gold. And the third one was from the Reform Congregation Temple Emmanuel, and that was Rabbi Marty Lawson. And they held forth about the differences among the movements, and it ran as a front page story, not in the Heritage. This was before I started with the Heritage. It was in the competitive paper, which was then called, I think, San Diego Israel Today or something like that.
Okay, so you fell in love with writing those stories.
Yeah, it was great. It really was. And ever since, I've always looked for Jewish angles to stories. And as a regional newspaper might ask for what's the El Cajon angle or the East County angle, I ask what's the Jewish angle.
Well, in Schlepping Through the American West, you and your grandson go on a 3,600-mile round-trip odyssey from San Diego to Alberta, Canada, discovering Jewish stories and links. How did that trip get started, and why the American West?
Well, I think it's kind of fascinating that here in San Diego, we have two northbound interstate freeways that actually cross. I-5, which goes north along the coast, and I-15. And I thought, well, that makes for an interesting route, wouldn't it, if you were to go up the I-15 all the way to Canada and then perhaps across and then come down to the 5 and end up at the same place. And I don't know why I became fixated on that, but I thought, gee, that would be a fun trip. And I asked Shore if he would like to go with me and see what we could find. And Shore's my grandson, and he said yes.
So when you took this trip, did you have it preset where you'd go or how you would dig up these stories, or was that spontaneous?
Well, it was a little of each. In some cases, we actually wrote ahead and knew that we wanted to go there and hoped that we could arrange interviews. In other places, it was just serendipitous. For example, one story I wrote was at an Indian reservation, the Blackfoot Indian Reservation. We went into a trading post. I happened to pick up a book there that was written by one of the members of the Blackfoot Indians, and found it so fascinating that I decided to devote a column or a story to that.
And you found a Jewish angle for that.
Well, the Jewish angle was the comparison, because they believe that, for example, mice can talk. They don't necessarily believe, but in their legends, the mice talk. And they also have ceremonies where they have their tobacco pipe and they wave it in the directions of the four directions and up and down. And I found similarities to Judaism in that. We have in Judaism in the Torah, the story of a donkey who was carrying a passenger and is stopped by an angel of the Lord and won't move. And the fellow riding him starts whacking him. And the donkey looks up and says, "Why are you hitting me? You know, haven't I always been good?" And so it's not all that amazing to have a story about a talking animal in a religious text. And similarly, we have a ceremony in Judaism where we wave our lulavs during the holiday of Sukkot and to the different directions. So it was a nice place to find a comparison.
Interesting. So the book is both a guidebook and it's a collection of tales. Could you share with us right now a little bit of your favorite tale?
Well, I don't know if it's my favorite.
One of your favorites.
One of my favorites. But one of the places that we went to was in Idaho. Remember, we're going along the Interstate 15, and we found out that the town of Blackfoot, Idaho, had the Potato Museum.
Okay.
And we thought, gee, what? That would be interesting, a Potato Museum. So I'll start a little bit of it. About the time that movie star Marilyn Monroe converted to Judaism in association with her marriage to playwright Arthur Miller, potato farmers and marketers in Idaho were talking about how beautiful a woman she was. Quote, "She's the kind of woman who would look good in anything, even a potato sack," said one. "Say, that's a brilliant idea," said another. "Let's see if we can get her to pose for our advertising campaign." They did, and she did, producing a memorable image of Monroe in a burlap bag. As was clear to everyone, she was outstanding in her field. The joke there being that she's standing in a potato field.
Oh,
the Monroe,
I didn't even get that. I got it now. Thank you.
The Monroe image is just one of the exhibits of the Idaho Potato Museum, which shares crowded quarters in a former railroad depot with the Blackfoot Chamber of Commerce. Here one can learn about the history of the Idaho potatoes, as well as about some of the innovations that have changed the way potatoes are planted and harvested. There are also interesting potato-based collections, such as postage stamps from around the world, featuring potatoes or their lore, an assemblage of Mr. Potato Head toys, and a one-of-a-kind souvenir, a potato signed by former U.S. Vice President Dan Quayle.
Oh, wonderful. It was really fun to read.
Do you remember Dan Quayle and his famous potato gaffe, and he wanted to put an extra E on it?
Yes.
So that's why they got him to sign the potato, and he was a good enough sport to do it.
Great. I know that one of your readers, Rabbi Ben Kamen, he called you not only the ultimate wandering Jew, but he said you're a highly valued wondering Jew. What other topics besides the themes that you've mentioned, potatoes and history, what other topics do you wonder about in Schlepping Through the American West? What topics do you think are relevant to everyone, no matter what their faith is?
Well, I think most of them are. There were perhaps one or two stories that you might say were almost exclusively Jewish. I dealt with a synagogue, a Jewish synagogue, obviously, and a Jewish cemetery in two different chapters. But the rest of them really were about Americana. And I look at these stories as tapestries, and through these tapestries there might be a Jewish thread here and there.
I
try to focus on the Jewish thread, but as well to tell the story of the place. So, for example, we went to the Buffalo Preserve up in Montana, the Bison Preserve, I should say properly, because they aren't really buffaloes, and talked about how Theodore Roosevelt was involved in the conservation of these incredible creatures who were slaughtered, unfortunately, during the 19th century and who faced extinction, and told about what the experience is like to drive through the National Bison Range and to see these creatures and have them come right up to your car. And at the same time wove through it the interesting fact, at least to me, that Moise, M-O-I-E-S-E, is the name of the town that the National Bison Range is in. And of course I drew the conclusion that Moise was a biblical name or from Moses. And found out that it was actually the name of the Native American who owned the area and who had been given his name by a church. And so my conclusion actually worked out that there was this Jewish thread running through it. And I talked about Theodore Roosevelt and Moses both being conservationists. And there's a famous Jewish story, we call him Midrashim, about Moses who had a sheep that wandered away from the flock, and he followed the sheep and he found the sheep drinking from the water, and he realized that the reason that the sheep had left was because he was so thirsty, and he felt sorry for the sheep. And so when he retrieved him, instead of being angry at him, he put him on his shoulders and he carried him back to the flock. And according to the story, God saw this and he says, if he treats the sheep so well, he'll also treat the Israelites well, and he'll be the leader. And so these kinds of stories, you try to weave together as you go to places that are of general sightseeing interest.
It really does sound like a tapestry.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the global stage for a moment. I know, a very hot topic. In any way, does all the unrest and violence in the Middle East affect your writing, your perspective, anything that you're doing?
It's an interesting question. When I say in the subtitle of the book that there's a Jewish story everywhere, I have, you might say, three reasons why I'm able to say that. Israel is one. I mean, everybody in the world, every country in the world, either has relations or refuses to have relations with Israel. And so that offers one, you might say, possible range of stories. Mm-hmm. And the other two kinds of stories is the Bible, which I've just mentioned. The Hebrew scriptures are known throughout the world and, sure. and so forth. And the third thing is that Jews have been a very peripatetic people. We traveled everywhere to a large degree because we were merchants and we would open up new trade routes and open up stores and so forth. And so you can always find from those three themes, some sort of a story. And occasionally the story may well be about Israel. In fact, let's see, I guess it's in Rancho San Diego, or El Cajon, I guess, is there's big skyline church. And if you go there, I mean, they're very Israel-oriented. They have a wall inside their atrium that looks like the Kotel, the Wailing Wall, or the mm-hmm. Western Wall of Jerusalem, where parishioners can stick notes into it, and they have two big pillars in that atrium that are supposed to be the pillars of Solomon. And it's an example of how important those scriptures are, not only to Jews, but to the Western religions.
Wonderful. You really have a lot to show us that's already been there, and we haven't looked at it quite that way. How about East County? Are there any stories that particularly focus in East County that you'd like to share with us?
Well, just briefly, there are some that I've always enjoyed. In La Mesa, for example, one of the landmarks there is Mount Nebo. And, of course, in the Bible, Mount Nebo was the place where Moses looked out over the Promised Land and then died, and he wasn't allowed to actually go to the Promised Land. I always wondered about that name, like, mm-hmm. gee, you get to look out, but you don't get to come down the mountain. But I guess the developers were thinking about the other Israelites who would actually go into the Promised Land and had a great view of it.
So La Mesa is the Promised Land.
Well, they were, as far as the developers, there was a right. fellow named Sherman Grable, who was a Methodist, and he used that metaphor. In Santee, at the Santee Lakes, it's one of my favorite places to go walking, and I draw inspiration from the way the different species get along. I have pictures of pelicans and cormorants sharing the same rock, and pictures of egrets and herons fishing from the same shore, and osprey and another egret up in the same tree. And so you get this sort of sense of a multiculturalism at the Santee Lakes. And yet at the nice. Same time, you also see flocks of ducks together, mm-hmm. of mud hens together. And so they have their separate cultures, but they also mingle together. And I think of that as a metaphor.
Yeah,
and
I love that metaphor.
And then finally in Lakeside, the old Lakeside hotel was at one point owned by the whole Rancho was owned by Adolf Levi, who was a fellow in Julian, who, if you ever go to the Julian drugstore, there's a plaque on the drugstore that mm-hmm. it was once owned by him. But he also purchased land, and so that area was owned by the Levi family. And so it's just another strand that runs through these tapestries.
Great, thanks for sharing those.
Sure.
Interesting. One last question. What are you writing next? Will it be more travels from a Jewish American grandfather, or will it be something entirely different?
Well, I have another book that I'm collating now. It's called Schlepping Over the High Seas.
Okay. And more schlepping.
I've done a lot of cruising, and just as I have done in the American West, whenever I get to a port, I try to find the Jewish story. And of course, there are many Jewish stories, on the ships. And so these are tapestries. They are stories about cruising, about the kinds of people you might meet on a cruise ship, about, places you might go or the cruise ship might take you. But I always try to find that little Jewish thread within those stories.
And when do you think it'll be available?
Well, I'm guessing sometime next year. It's a matter now of pulling stories from, I've been a journalist for over 50 years, and I'm trying to go back and to find some of those stories that meet the theme. And that takes a little while, and maybe I'll go on a cruise or two between now and then.
Oh, you'll have to go on a cruise. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Don, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly enjoyed the interview.
For more information on Don Harrison and his work, please visit sdjewishworld.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Leon Thompson with some holiday travel tips. If you're planning to travel out of the country over the holidays, now is the time to apply for your passport, book, or card. A passport is required for international air travel and also for crossing the international borders into Mexico or Canada. The county clerk offers passport walk-in services with no appointment necessary at its office downtown from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. It can take 4 to 6 weeks to get a routine passport, so it's best to apply for passports now. If you're traveling in less than 2 weeks or need a foreign visa in less than 4 weeks, you can contact the U.S. Department of State's San Diego Passport Agency at 1 Columbia Place downtown. An appointment is required at the State Department's Passport Agency and can be made by calling 877-487-2778. To quickly process your passport application, be prepared with a completed application, but don't sign it ahead of time. You will also need proof of U.S. citizenship, such as birth certificate or certificate of naturalization, and proof of identity, which must be a government-issued ID. You will also need a photo, or one will be taken, along with payment in cash, check, or money order. All applicants must appear in person. You can find additional information on the Clerk of the Board's passport application website.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykle, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.